Unabashed.
The most unpredictable
becomes a headline.
The most volatile,
outrageous behavior,
unsubstantiated narratives,
a battle of personalities.
Welcome to Grand Tamasha, a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. I'm your host, Milan Vaishnav. On April 11th, Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan was ousted from office, having suffered defeat in a dramatic no-confidence vote in the National Assembly. Soon after, Shahbaz Sharif, former Chief Minister of Punjab and brother of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, was sworn into office as his replacement, capping a dizzying few weeks of political intrigue. To make sense of the latest developments in Pakistan, including what they mean for India, I am joined today by Akhil Shah. Akhil is the Wick Carey Associate Professor in the Department of International and Area Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and more importantly to us, he is also a visiting scholar in the South Asia program at Carnegie. He is the author of The Army and Democracy, Military Politics in Pakistan, one of the best guides we have to understanding civil-military relations in Pakistan. I am pleased to welcome him to the show for the very first time. Akhil, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me, Milan. I'm happy to be here.
So I want to go back and do a little bit of history before we get into what's currently happening on the ground. Back in March, on March 8th, a group of opposition parties submitted a motion of no confidence against the Prime Minister Imran Khan to the Secretariat of the National Assembly. Our listeners may recall Khan was elected back in 2018. His term was not due to end until August of next year, 2023. After 4 years in office, maybe you could kind of set the scene for us. You know, how did Khan find himself in this difficult, ultimately unfortunate for him, predicament?
Imran Khan is a former cricketing superstar who came into politics promising that he was going to disrupt Pakistan's traditional dynastic politics, you know, eradicate corruption, and found himself in the political wilderness for almost two decades. Until I think the Pakistan Army decided that they needed a third force in politics to oppose the two sort of traditional political parties, the Pakistan People's Party, a former Prime Minister, late Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, and the Pakistan Muslim League of Nawaz Sharif. The two parties had dominated electoral politics, and the military sees them as, you know, dynastic, corrupt politicians. So they wanted this. They toyed with the idea of a third option. And so the level playing field for the other opposition's party was, you know, not level. It was tilted in favor of Imran Khan. So he earned himself the title of the selected prime minister of Pakistan rather than the elected prime minister. And he made much of being on the same page with the army, which basically means that the army was, you know, supporting him. In previous, you know, in previous decades, whenever there was a conflict between the army and the prime minister, the army usually prevailed either by, you know, executing a coup or using the presidency or the judiciary to get rid of the sort of disobedient prime minister. But this time, it seemed like everything was hunky-dory. Khan was, you know, under almost no constraint from the military to implement his agenda. And he made, you know, a series of promises, eradicating corruption, revitalizing Pakistan's economy. But the reality was very different. And so very quickly, especially in Punjab, which is, you know, Pakistan's political heartland, is the largest province, but also the politically most important province, you know, allegations of corruption, mismanagement, and misgovernance began to emerge. Khan had appointed a sort of a political non-entity as the chief minister of Punjab. And the idea, I think, was that Khan would be able to control the province and its affairs from the center. But the military, in the meanwhile, was getting the flak for all the misgovernance and the allegations of corruption that were in the air. Khan also, or Khan's team, was not able to manage the economy very well. Inflation was sort of rampant. Unemployment was rising. Pakistan's debt burden was increasing. So I think the military, by association with Imran Khan, was getting a lot of flack, was sort of taking hits to its public reputation. However, I think the breaking point was Khan tried to basically prevent the Army Chief General Bajwa from appointing an ISI chief of his own choice. So the incumbent chief of the ISI, General Faiz Hamid, had actually helped Imran Khan in 2018, helped him come to power. Even though General Faiz Hamid was not a rogue actor, he was acting under directions from the Army Chief, General Bajwa. Imran Khan thought that if he could retain Faiz Hamid in the ISI and then have him eventually promoted to the Chief of Army Staff, Khan could probably use his help to win the next election. And so the real conflict was centered on this, Khan's insistence that he retain the ISI chief. The Army chief announced the appointment of a new ISI chief, another general, and then Khan refused to sign off on the sort of the formality of signing off on his appointment and delayed it, which became quite embarrassing for the Army. He eventually relented, but I think the seeds of discord had been sown by then. And I think it was sort of the development of these differences, at least domestically, that kind of created the window of opportunity for the opposition to coalesce and sort of, you know, try to oust him through a no-confidence vote.
So you mentioned that Khan came to power initially in 2018 with the support of the military. That eventually was his undoing. We'll talk more about that in a second. But do we have any sense of what the true nature of his popular support was? Like, do we have any independent metrics we can look at to say, well, you know, that he did get a certain amount of popular legitimacy because of fatigue or what have you with the prevailing kind of two political poles?
Yes. So he is, you know, popular amongst Pakistan's urban middle class professionals and youth, especially in large urban centers, including in the Punjab. The problem with that kind of popularity is that it doesn't really correlate with Pakistan's electoral arithmetic. Punjab, which has, you know, almost half the seats in the lower house of the Parliament National Assembly, is, you know, has constituencies where local politics or politics of sort of kinship or, you know, networks, personalistic or family networks dominate. The Pakistan Muslim League is also very popular in these parties, in these areas. So Khan's popularity no doubt exists. But even despite the military sort of aiding and abetting him in the election, he couldn't even muster a simple majority. So I think the logic of sort of the demographic or geographical distribution of Pakistan's electoral map, even if we concede that he's very popular among significant sections of Pakistan, sort of urban middle class, it doesn't really mean that he was electorally in a position to win an election.
I think many of our listeners, myself included, struggled to fully understand and follow all of the contours of the constitutional crisis that the no confidence vote triggered. And here's what I think happened, and you tell me if I got it right. So rather than face a no-confidence vote that he was likely to lose, Imran Khan advised the president to dissolve the National Assembly, which typically would have triggered fresh elections, perhaps even military intervention, but behind Khan. The matter got transferred to the Supreme Court, where Khan's decision was overruled, and then the no-confidence motion was held, eventually ousting Khan from his position. Is that sequence of events more or less correct?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I think it's a very complicated situation, so many moving parts, but I think you nailed it. Yeah. The only thing I would add is that when the vote of no confidence was tabled in the parliament, constitutionally, the Speaker of the House had to, act on it. And rather than during the actual session where the no confidence was tabled, rather than having it voted on, he basically said, according to Article 5 of the Constitution, which basically expects Pakistani citizens to be loyal to the state, Article 5 of the Constitution, this vote of no confidence violates that article because the entire opposition is, you know, acting at the behest of a foreign power. This is the conspiracy that Imran Khan tried to cook up to, you know, sort of mobilize his support base. So At that time, the deputy speaker of the assembly adjourned the session and said, this vote of no confidence is unconstitutional because, you know, the entire opposition is basically traitors. So that was the one step that was missing. But otherwise, this is exactly how it unfolded.
So let's talk about this step, because this step has gotten a lot of media attention, right? One of the major subplots in this whole drama was Khan's accusation that his ouster was essentially the product of a Western, read U.S., conspiracy, right? He pointed to a secret diplomatic cable that was allegedly sent by a senior State Department official that threatened Pakistan that basically, if he was not removed from office, that there would be consequences. What do we know about this cable? Was it a genuine diplomatic cable? And if so, what did it actually say?
His claim was that the Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Central Affairs, Donald Liu, and the Pakistani ambassador met. And the American side told the ambassador that, you know, Pakistan's relation will only improve if Khan was voted out. And if the vote of no confidence did not succeed, that there will be serious complications or consequences for Pakistan. And the alleged American displeasure was attributed by Khan and his aides to, Pakistan's tilt towards Russia, Imran Khan's visit to Moscow, which was, you know, obviously very ill-timed just on the eve of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so his claim was that since he was trying to pursue an independent foreign policy, the Biden administration wanted to oust him. I think, my opinion, Khan never really got over the fact that after assuming office, Biden never called him, which is sort of the norm. And when he was desperate desperate to hold on to power, when the no confidence motion was underway, he came up with this sort of, you know, Western conspiracy to sort of stir up his support and, you know, try to pitch himself as this, you know, Pakistani leader who had. The first Pakistani leader after, you know, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto in the 70s, he also made that reference that he had been Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, that Kissinger got rid of him, or the Americans got rid of him, and the same is happening to me. But as we know, I mean, if the Biden administration wanted regime change in Pakistan, it's quite unlikely that they would send a State Department official to, you know, in a meeting to threaten Pakistan. So the National Security Committee affirmed that, you know, there was some undiplomatic language used and, you know, that it amounted to interference. But the second meeting of the National Security Committee under the new prime minister categorically said that there was no conspiracy, that there was zero evidence of any foreign conspiracy. So yesterday, Imran Khan tweeted a video from a Fox News show in which, you know, this relatively unknown American analyst, defense analyst, is making the claim that, you know, Pakistan's prime minister was removed because of his opposition to President Biden. And Khan has made a big deal out of that, that this is actual proof that, you know, the Biden administration is actually responsible for regime change in Pakistan.
Before we move on, what does this all mean, the sequence of events? You had a foreign affairs piece, we're linked to that in the show notes, where you noted this was the first time in Pakistan's history that the head of government was removed through a constitutional procedure rather than through a military coup or a judicial ruling. Tell us about what this moment, like, what did you learn about Pakistani institutions after you kind of watching the sequence of events play out?
So, as you know, Pakistan has had a long history of military coups, followed by, you know, at least a decade of military rule every time. And even when the military is out of power and there's a nominally elected government in power in Islamabad, the military is the most politically powerful actor and a veto player. So this history of coups and military intervention has, you know, rendered the Pakistani political system very weakly institutionalized. And not just in the sense of sort of, you know, the weakness or non-durability of formal constitutional and political arrangements, but also in the sense that there's a lack of any sort of established consensus amongst the politically significant actors, whether they're political parties or the judiciary, on the basic rules of the game. So there's no commitment. Throughout history, there has been almost no commitment to the fundamental rules of the democratic game, which almost always lead to conflicts, whether it's between the prime minister and the judiciary or the military and the prime minister, with the judiciary trying to sort of play as an arbiter. And there's a long history of judicial interventions, too, often legitimizing the military's position and sort of legalizing military, too. So what I think it tells you is that Pakistan is primarily a sort of Praetorian or garrison state with weak levels of institutionalization. And so the fact that no prime minister has ever really completed a full sort of tenure in office, this was the first time that, you know, rather than a military coup displacing a prime minister or a judge throwing him out of office, that this was a sort of constitutional process was followed. So at least on the surface, at least symbolically, it's very important. But at the end of the day, the Imran Khan government fell primarily because the military, the army chief of staff, decided that they would no longer back him, which then created the sort of conditions for the opposition to bring about this vote of no confidence.
Hey, Grant the Masha listeners, thanks for listening to the podcast. Putting this show together each week is a labor of love, but it takes a lot of work to put out a great show every week. If you'd like to support the work we do at Grant the Masha, please visit ceip.org/donate. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on your favorite podcasting platform, so you'll be the first to know when a new episode rolls out. Right. So on the one hand, you know, going back to what you said earlier, Imran Khan may have come to office on the backs of considerable support from the military, but he left perhaps only after the military determined that he was expendable. Right. So one of the pieces, I think, one of the things that you say in your foreign affairs piece is that net, the military central role in politics hasn't really changed very much. Right.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, What changed with this was that the military, rather than actively trying to prop up Imran Khan or doing the nasty things that the ISI typically does to, you know, divide and rule the politicians, they just stayed back. They just decided not to intervene and let the, you know, house of cards that they had built fall on its own. So that's precisely what happened.
So let's turn to the present now. We have a new government in office. It's headed by the former Punjab Chief Minister Shehbaz Sharif. As I mentioned earlier, he is the brother of the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Tell us a little bit about who Shehbaz Sharif is. You know, what does his background tell us, if anything, about how he might govern? You know, keeping in mind that he doesn't have a very long tenure, right, given that elections are due in 2023.
So Shehbaz Sharif, as you mentioned earlier, has been chief minister of Punjab thrice. This is his first time of, you know, holding high office at the national level. He is generally known to be a very effective and dedicated sort of public servant, administrator, takes pride in, you know, efficiently governing. And his track record in Punjab shows that. He introduced some extensive reforms, for instance, in the education sector. He was very, he executed big infrastructure projects like, roads, as well as a commuter rail or commuter bus, I think it's called, or the Orange Line in Lahore. And so he's known to be a sort of no-nonsense politician. So this rule really is a test of those abilities or his reputation as a good governor, as a good administrator. This will be really tested out at the national level. The other thing that is important about Shehbaz Sharif, that unlike Nawaz Sharif, who has usually sort of crossed swords with the military, he has a more realpolitik, pragmatic approach to civil-military relations. He believes in not, you know, ruffling too many feathers, just taking the military alongside, the civilian government. And I think his philosophy is that if you govern effectively, you can basically, if you outperform, the military and other governments, that's the best way to take Pakistan forward, rather than trying to reform or civil-military relations or trying to redirect fundamentally how Pakistan is structured.
I mean, you mentioned that, you know, this is going to be a real test of his abilities at the national level. I mean, Pakistan is facing no shortage of challenges on the governance front, right? It is in the midst of an inflationary economic crisis. It continues to be a safe haven for militant groups, terrorist groups operating in the region. It's also a principal victim of terrorism itself. In your view, is the current civilian government adequately equipped to handle what are very almost intractable, you know, overlapping crises?
Yeah, it's a very tough situation. I think this is a government formed by a sort of coalition of the PMLN and its traditional rival, the PPP, and also some small parties. And they have a very short time before the next election, so about a year and a year and a half. And all these crises have sort of come together. So they're in a sort of crisis management mode. And I think the first priority is to try to stabilize the economy. And so one of the first things the government did was to dispatch the new finance minister to Washington to get some sort of renew Pakistan's loan facility with the IMF. But Pakistan also has, in return for getting that loan, has to implement some, belt tightening measures that will really affect how this government is perceived. So Pakistan has had a long sort of, there's a long pattern of providing subsidies on energy tariffs and on fuel or petrol. And so one of the IMF's conditions is if you want to reduce deficits, you have to take these subsidies out. But that's going to, adversely affect the proverbial man or woman in the street. If you increase the prices of fuel, everything else goes up, and food inflation has already been very high. So the economic crisis, I think, is the primary focus of this government. It's going to be tough. They'll have to make some tough decisions, but making those tough decisions is likely to sort of undercut the goodwill or the sort of popularity that they're counting on for the next election. So I wouldn't wish the situation on my enemy. So it's a very tough act, but there are some competent, capable cabinet ministers in the government.
So this, of course, is an India-focused podcast, so I have to ask you about the ramifications for India. In your foreign affairs piece, you noted that Imran Khan's harsh criticism of the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his decision to block trade with India contradicted General Bajwa's more conciliatory approach towards New Delhi. Are there any lessons to be learned in this affair about the kind of near-term prospects for India-Pakistan relations? Has anything fundamentally changed in the Pakistani ecosystem to suggest that these bilateral ties, which have been on a kind of perpetual downswing, could be reversed?
Not really. I mean, as you know, the Pakistani army tightly controls what Pakistan's foreign policy, especially towards what it considered to be its arch enemy, India. And so Bajwa and the army high command, it seems that they don't want to, obviously, I mean, they justify their existence and their sort of, huge budgets and legitimacy on the fight with India. It did seem at around 2018, 2019, that Bajwa reached out to India through his intelligence. There were some back channel talks about, conveying to his Indian counterparts that, he doesn't want to up the ante in Kashmir, that, he wants more or less sort of a peaceful arrangement. So if that is actually true, if Bajwa really is, or the Army High Command really has had a change of heart, which I highly doubt, you might see sort of at least overtly less hostile engagement with India. I mean, Imran Khan just went over the board and started calling, the BJP the Nazi Party and fascism, and as a prime minister. And then he took a U-turn and said, India is a great example of a independent foreign policy because look at them, they're getting oil from Russia. And so there's a sort of schizophrenic sort of view of the world that Khan has. So I don't think in the short term, Pakistan-India relations would drastically deteriorate and improve. But Shehbaz Sharif, I think, sort of started it off on a good note and, wrote a letter to Prime Minister Modi saying we seek peaceful relations. And traditionally, Pakistan's politicians or mainstream politicians, both the PPP and PMLN, especially at PMLN, Nawaz Sharif has in the past sought to sort of mend fences with India, reduce tensions, which has gotten him into trouble with the military. Here, the case seems to be the opposite, where Khan tried to sort of, you know, play the sort of more hawkish game, and the military said, cool it down, you know, we don't need any more problems with India. And even in the United States, after this regime change conspiracy, Bajwa made it very clear in a public speech that, you know, the United States is one is our largest exporter, and we seek a constructive strategic relationship with the United States. So there's no need to, you know, they don't want the Pakistani army, you know, values American weaponry and technology and don't want to ruffle up too many feathers in a relationship that's already gone quite cold, especially after the American withdrawal from Afghanistan.
So just to talk about Imran Khan's kind of future prospects, he is not going quietly into the night, right? He is using whatever platform he has, including Twitter, to blast the current government, to criticize the army chief, which is pretty remarkable, and to plot his comeback. Can Imran Khan, in your view, have a successful second act in politics?
So Imran Khan is taking the approach, you know, if you take a cricket metaphor, if I can't play, nobody else can play, right? So he is willing to sort of bring the house down in order to have another crack at power. So, you know, his aides have threatened civil war and violence, and his supporters have taken, as you said, targeted General Bajwa in an unprecedented sort of anti-army or anti-military campaign on social media. The problem is that Imran Khan's performance three and a half, four years has not earned him, you know, too many fans in the general public. If there is a free and fair election, you know, both opinion polls and most experts will tell you that Imran Khan's chances of actually coming back to power anytime soon are slim to none, and that the people he has surrounded himself, the party, his party is not really his party. It's Imran Khan plus remnants of, you know, the former Musharraf regime or people from other parties who are likely to abandon him now that the establishment has withdrawn its support. So he's really sort of out in the wilderness and is trying to maximize his, you know, his sort of populist personalist appeal to his support base, but also more broadly by trying to delegitimize this government as what he calls an imported government. And, you know, the Pakistanis being compromised. The only problem with this his early demise is that some of the effects of his policy, some of the sort of more non-popular or unpopular effects of his economic policies, now that this government's in power for a year, it would allow him to sort of distance himself from those policies or their effects and blame it on this government. So some of the flack that Imran Khan would have, you know, been subject to will now pass on to this government because now they're in the driving seat and they're responsible for making all the tough policy decisions.
So one final question for you, Akhil, which is on Afghanistan. We don't really talk about it anymore because all of our focus is on Russia-Ukraine, but it wasn't that long ago that we saw a dramatic upheaval in Kabul and the return of the Taliban. There is still a humanitarian crisis going on. There is still grave concern about the security of the population, particularly women and girls. A lot of people, a lot of political analysts, I should say, saw this Taliban resurgence as a victory for Pakistan, that they would have a regime that was perhaps more aligned with their views, particularly the militaries. You know, here we are, not quite a year later, but getting there. You know, how do things look in the neighborhood right now? Has the situation in Pakistan, the situation in Afghanistan fundamentally changed anything in Pakistan, either domestically or externally?
So I think the Pakistani military's bet was that once the Taliban are in power, you know, they will have, they've strategically viewed Afghanistan as this sort of reservoir of strategic depth, and a stable Afghanistan, a peaceful Afghanistan is in Pakistan's interest. But I think they were really hoping that the Taliban would crack down, or at least support Pakistan's crackdown, or, you know, on the Pakistani wing of the Taliban, the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which has found sanctuary in Afghanistan, and the Taliban have done nothing but sort of offer, you know, vague promises of will intervene. There has been some in, you know, mediation by the Haqqani faction of Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, to try to convince their Pakistani Taliban friends to not attack Pakistan. But if you look at the spike in terror attacks on Pakistani security forces and civilians, it tells you the Taliban are not doing what Pakistan had hoped they would do, right? Because, you know, you are our clients, we helped you, you help us back. So what Pakistan has now done is it sends its air force into, you know, Afghanistan to strike at some of the leaders of the Pakistani Taliban. Because the TTP is, you know, has a sanctuary, it's sort of a reverse situation where the Afghan Taliban enjoyed a sanctuary, was able to attack, you know, U.S., NATO, and Afghan forces and find, you know, come back to Pakistan. The TTP seemed to be doing the same. They're well entrenched in the border areas on the Afghanistan side, and they've sort of been, you know, and they've carried out a sort of, you know, pretty vicious campaign of terrorism along that area, but also deep into Pakistan. And that has Pakistan's military establishment worried. So they're now taking matters into their own hands. So no, the idea was that the Taliban would restore, you know, Pakistan's traditional influence in Afghanistan, would kick India out, which is what Pakistan feared. But now that India is out, you know, they have this other problem that they can't really wish away. They have tried, you know, over and over to convince the Taliban to sort of say, well, you know, and the Taliban have come out with saying, we will not allow our territory to be used for terrorism in any country, but that's not true. So Pakistan's, you know, has this sort of, you know, it's a terrible sort of blowback or consequence of Pakistan's policy.
My guest on the show this week is Akhil Shah. He is an associate professor at the University of Oklahoma and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment. He is the author of The Army and Democracy, Military Politics in Pakistan. Akhil, you have been in high demand given the events unfolding on the ground in Pakistan. Thank you for sharing a bit of your time with us today.
Thank you, Milan.
Grant Thamasha is a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. This podcast is an HD Smartcast original and is available on hdsmartcast.com. India's fastest growing podcasting platform. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review. It helps others find the show more easily. For more information about the show and to find the writing we reference on this week's episode, visit our website, grantthamasha.com. Production assistance comes from Caroline Duckworth. Tim Martin is our audio engineer, and Cliff Jayapranada is our executive producer. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
This was a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.